Hi, everyone. Welcome to a little bit of a different New Insight podcast episode. We're just coming off the heels of ASRS. And so our fabulous behind the scenes guru, Connor, and I kind of thought about, you know, how we should maybe present some of the data that came out of this meeting. And so what I told Connor is maybe we'll do a little Ask Me Anything episode. And I have left it to Connor to decide kind of what the biggest buzz was from ASRS. And to kind of pepper us with questions here and maybe some data points that we can kind of talk and give some hot takes on maybe what came out of this really important pivotal meeting. I think a lot of you that were there know that there was a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement, a lot of good news, a lot of bad news. And so let's dig right in. Connor, if you want to introduce yourself real quickly here.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Dr. Schett. Yeah, I'm Connor Iaposti. I'm an associate editor of medical news site HCP Live. As Dr. Schett said, I had the chance to attend ASRS 2023. Thought it was a great meeting. Had a chance to speak to a lot of great people on some important data. Figure we can just kind of run through it. So the first one, if you just want to get started, Dr. Schett, is the pegcetacoplan versus avacincaptad-pegol in patients with GA and anchored matching adjusted indirect comparison at the phase 3 trials. I know you and I both agree it was pretty interesting. So I wanted to sort of get your take on, you know, I guess just the comparison itself and what that could represent.
Yeah. So this is a great one. I think this definitely created a lot of buzz. Look, this was a great presentation by Paul Hahn. I think he did a really great job. But when you look at it, it's a really different type of data presentation than we're used to at these meetings, right? This was not a randomized controlled trial. It's not a phase 1, 2, 3 type of trial. This was an MAIC or a matching adjusted indirect comparison that Paul did, looking at, like you said, pegcetacoplan versus ACP, Zimura, Izervay, whatever we want to call it now that it's got approval. So it's interesting because, you know, I think during our training and for those of us that are involved in clinical trials, you know, you're told over and over again, you can't kind of compare across clinical trials, right? And we hear this all the time. And so the question is, well, how did Paul do that here? And why did he do that? And is this an accepted kind of way of comparing two different study drugs that were not compared head to head? And so, you know, for people that really haven't been familiar with this type of MAIC methodology, I think it's important for us before we kind of dive into what Paul found is to talk about why this type of a comparison even exists. And, you know, this is not a unique type of comparison that Paul did. This is something that we've seen in healthcare time and time again. We see it a lot in oncology. We're just starting to see it in ophthalmology as we get newer and newer treatments available. Like in the old days when all we had was one anti-VEGF or two anti-VEGFs, we didn't really talk about these types of kind of cross-trial comparisons, but we do now because we've got lots of different potential options for our patients. And so that, you know, that's one reason that this kind of a comparison exists. The other is, look, some regulatory organizations require it. I mean, this has been something that's been required in Europe for a long time. And even US payers are starting to require these types of comparisons because ultimately, again, when there's multiple options, payers want to figure out, like, what do we pay for and, you know, what kind of market is set by these newer treatments, right? So, again, you know, it's not a new concept, but it's somewhat new in our scientific meetings. And so I think it was worth kind of maybe a second to just talk about that. You know, what did Paul find? Paul found that, you know, when you compare the subsets of patients that are similar in OAKS, for example, and a similar cohort maybe that was in GATHER2, so the two different studies, two different sponsors, again, not compared directly, but when you kind of boil it down to similar patient populations, what can you say about the efficacy of these treatments, especially with the efficacy compared to one another? And what he found was in his analysis, he looked at it and he said, look, there was a 37%, I think, significant reduction in GA with pegcetacoplan versus ACP. And so, and it was 37% in OAKS. And then when he looked at DERBY, it was 12.1%. So, you know, it's great. Like, look, we always, when we have different treatments, I mean, like it goes back to like protocol T, right? That was the first and kind of only time we really compared different agents against each other. And so this is kind of looking to mimic that. So in our minds, we get an idea, okay, maybe one drug works better than the other. Okay, but maybe what's the downside of this, right? Again, why is it that we don't want to do cross-trial comparisons? And the reason is, you know, what we're taught fundamentally is, look, these are different clinical trials. They're looking at potentially different patient populations. They're looking at different inclusion and exclusion criteria. And so there's a lot of potential variables that can muddy the water so that you're not looking at apples versus apples. You're looking at apples versus oranges. And that's always the risk you run of comparing these things. So the way they try to get around that is say, look, well, we're going to take the demographics that we know, and we're going to try and get similar groups from each of these studies and just compare those subset of patients. And so, yeah, that like theoretically makes sense, but it's fraught with all kinds of potential issues. And look, the biggest one being you can kind of cherry pick which demographic data, you know, which kind of factors you want to select. And I can tell you that if you run this data set and pick certain demographic data, and then you pick a different set of demographic data, you may get totally different results at the end of the day. And so that's kind of the downside to something like this. Again, I think it's cool to see it. It's a creative kind of way of looking at it. Look, it's a necessary way of looking at it because of some of the demands through regulatory agencies. But, you know, it's fraught with potential issues. And so I kind of take the results with a grain of salt. And the other issue I think I had personally with this one is that I think we compared like individual trials like Oaks and Derby versus Gather 2, but there was no mention of Gather 1, which was genuinely a registration study for Iveric. And so why was that not included? And if we did include that Gather 1 data, would that have changed the results? And so, you know, I think there's a lot, you know, this is not the last MAIC type of presentation we're going to see. But it's the first memorable one. So I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's worth talking about it. You know, this is one that I talked to my fellow about because I think it brings up a lot of points, especially if you're interested in clinical trials and interested in kind of being involved in them, you know, the pluses and minuses of something like this. And so again, you know, the data I think that he presented was interesting, but again, I take it with a grain of salt.
So let me ask you, you know, you mentioned sort of the regulatory aspect of it potentially being something in the future. Do you think specifically for this one, it's just the, you know, these agents are so new, they're first of its kind, so it sort of makes sense to introduce it at this point? Or is that more of sort of a general thing that's going to start happening in ophthalmology? I know you mentioned oncology has been doing it. Is this just sort of what's moving forward, or is it just sort of this new GA drug class?
No, I think it's, I think that we've actually seen it in some of the anti-VEGF class. I think that these MAICs have been run by drug companies, but they're not published in ophthalmology journals. They're published in like industry journals, if they're published at all. You know, a lot of times they're just part of the regulatory package that's delivered to the agencies. It has only been recently where we're starting to see this huge growth of publications in this MAIC data. So if you look 5 or 6 years ago, I don't think that there was really even a handful of these publications in our space. And now you're seeing multiple, but again, they're not in opto or retina journals. They're in industry journals or like management journals. And so I think that's to your point, I think we're going to see more of it. The real question is, are we going to see more of it at our scientific meetings like ASRS? And I think my short answer is you won't see a bunch right away, but I think over time as new treatments do come out, you're going to see it. Why? Because I think that there's a marketing message a little bit behind it too. Like people want to know like, hey, what's the difference? And what can I tell my patients? If I, you know, am a physician that selects a certain product over another, I want to be able to give some element of data or some confidence in that selection. And so maybe there's a little bit of that to it as well, right?
You know, I think we hit on some interesting points about sort of the new GA drug class. So for this one specifically, there was some new data presented on the long-term efficacy of pegcetacoplan in patients with GA. So I want to ask you, you know, what did you find interesting about this? Why is it so important? What should clinicians know?
Yeah. So Nate Steinle presented some Gale, early Gale extension data. What is Gale? Gale was an extension to Derby and Oaks. So we kind of teased that concept with the last presentation. So Derby and Oaks looked at pegcetacoplan for our GA patients. The phase three studies were 2-year studies. Gale is a 3-year extension of those studies. And so I think they had 80% of patients from the core studies roll over into this extension. And it's understandable. These are patients that during the time of the study had no treatment options and they had already gone through 2 years of the study and they decided, yeah, I would love to keep going with it. And we're glad they did, right? Because, you know, one of the things that's coming up now is, you know, we've got treatment options for these GA patients. What the GA patients want to know is, what are these drugs going to do for me? And so with the initial data sets, we can tell them, hey, look, at the end of 1 year, you can expect, you know, this much of a difference potentially between no treatment and being treated. At the end of 2 years, and we've seen that now, 2-year data with Derby and Oaks. We're going to see, hopefully, 2-year data with the GATHER2 study from Iveric at some point in the near future, hopefully. And, you know, what we're seeing in this, the pattern that we're seeing is that the difference, that delta between treated and untreated, is growing over time. In other words, you're changing the trajectory of that patient's disease, not only at day one, but at month six, at year one, at year two, and that delta keeps growing over time. And so what Nate presented at ASRS was that delta, that change, that increase in delta continued on. And so I think he presented data from the first 6 months of the extension, which means basically these are patients where they collected data from month 24 to month 30. And what he found was that the pegcetacoplan injection reduced non-subfoveal GA lesion growth by up to 45%, right? So, you know, right now, here we are in clinic, we're starting to use these treatments. We're quoting numbers like 25-35%. You know, when we looked at the 2-year data, we knew it was in the 30s. Hey, we're looking at beyond year two and into year three, and we're seeing 45% in certain subgroups. So that's great. Like, we want to see that because, again, it reinforces to our patients why we're starting this treatment and why they should maintain that treatment or stay on this treatment, because, you know, the longer they're on this, the more that impact we're having on the disease. So I think that was the real value of that, is that a lot of us kind of hypothesize that as these studies go longer and longer, we're going to see that divide between treated and untreated kind of continue to grow. And this kind of reinforced that. So I'm hoping that we see more and more data like this, whether it's from the Gale extension, you know, we're talking, you know, 6 months later, and then another 6 months into year four and year five, or it's the extension data that GATHER2 study is going into. And so that, you know, that's just, again, good information for us as clinicians, because that's information we can give our patients and referring doctors as well.
So let me ask you, you know, obviously outside of Dr. Steinle's presentation, there was a lot of discussion about sort of the safety concerns surrounding pegcetacoplan. So let me ask you, you know, what should clinicians know and sort of be aware of about these reports?
Yeah, you know, I think it's still early in our understanding of what's happening. You know, at the ASRS, they did present, the rest committee did present some of these cases and these findings. And, you know, what's the good and the bad? The good is that it seems like it's a fairly low number of cases. The bad is that these cases exist and we need to know why, and we need to know exactly what's happening. Is it a certain, you know, reaction that the patient's having? Is it endophthalmitis? Is it something else? So, like I said, we're kind of in inning number one or two of this 9-inning game that we're going to play. And we're just starting to kind of get a better understanding of how much of this is happening, right? I think first and foremost, we need to understand, how big of a problem is this? Is it a little problem? Is it a big problem? It's obviously a huge problem for the patients that this happened to. And so, look, it's on everybody's radar. Everybody's thinking about it. It was obviously one of the biggest things that was talked about at ASRS. And so I think as clinicians and you know, folks that are treating patients with GA, it's certainly something that we are paying a lot of attention to, very close attention to. And anytime we get an update, we're kind of taking that information and figuring out how we're going to apply it clinically.
Daily imaging with home OCT among treatment-naive neovascular AMD participants. You know, I think this one was particularly interesting to me because I was thinking about what Dr. Duker said in a previous episode of New Insight about, you know, having the first OCT machine. I think that It's just sort of showing how things have changed in that period. So I want to ask you a little bit about that, sort of what it could represent for the future of the field.
Yeah, that's a great segue. So for any of you listeners that haven't heard the Jay Duker episode, go back and listen to it, because we really go into kind of the future of retina. And look, I think, one, it was nice to see this presentation. It looks like, patients did pretty well with the home OCT. I think the biggest thing was there was a high satisfaction rate with it. There's a little bit of a learning curve, I think, that was described in the presentation. But once patients got used to it, they didn't mind it. It took about, I think, 45 or 47 seconds per scan or something like that, and which, is not a huge kind of time commitment or commitment in general from a patient that's doing this maybe in their morning routine, for example. So, what bigger picture, right? We talked about this in the Duker episode, which is, where is retina going? Where is ophthalmic treatment going? The more options we have, whether it's for wet AMD or GA or any new indication that starts coming into play, the more patients we're going to have to manage. We're going to have to see these patients in clinic, potentially treat them in the office. And if that happens, we're going to potentially run out of space, run out of chair time, run out of whatever it is. And so one of the things that can offset that is if we're able to keep some of these patients at home, monitoring them remotely with something like a home OCT, like a neovascular AMD patient, for example. Let's say you treated them, you got them loaded up, you're comfortable with how they're doing from a disease standpoint, they're stable. Okay, well, great. Send them home with the home OCT. And when that home OCT alerts, we bring them back in and we treat them, right? There's lots of kinks to work out from an operational standpoint, but that theoretically could make room for patients that have GA that now need treatment or whatever it is that we're treating at that point. So I think it's absolutely something that I'm excited that we're exploring. I'm excited to think about kind of how it may be incorporated into our routine, into our plan, which patients get. It's not going to be for everybody. I think one thing that was brought up in the presentation is, you had a number of patients that didn't continue on. Why? Because they traveled, right? We're in Chicago. We have snowbirds. They leave for Florida or Arizona. Are they taking that home OCT with them? It's a 16-pound machine. They're probably not grabbing that and going with it. So I think that's something to consider too. So I think there's still a lot to work out. But look, presentations like this reinforce that it's absolutely something we can make work as long as the technology is accurate and as long as we have a plan for when those alerts happen. We can get those patients in, get them treated. And we're not sacrificing visual outcomes or putting that patient at risk. And I think there is a way forward with it. And I would not be surprised if in a few years it's part of our kind of toolbox that we have for patients.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what you think the timeline sort of looks like. Is this something that you foresee in the next decade, or is this something that we need to keep working towards? And also the technology itself might progress to the point that it makes it easier as well.
Yeah, listen, I think the like you said, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have even like kind of fathomed it, because we were looking at Heidelbergs and Zeiss OCTs, and they were really expensive and the optics were really big and heavy and clunky. I mean, if you're miniaturizing everything and you're making it user friendly where, it really doesn't even require a camera operator, then I think absolutely it's something that we can achieve sooner rather than later. You gave me a 10-year horizon. I would say, and I wouldn't be surprised if in 5 years this is in people's homes. Maybe not ubiquitous, but certainly people that maybe have a hard time coming to clinic. Remote patients, or we have colleagues that work in areas that patients travel 2-3 hours sometimes for their follow up. And so, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could keep them at home and prevent them from having to go back and forth and only come in when they needed to, right? So I think that's maybe how it starts, and then it maybe rolls out to the larger population.
And yeah, so the next presentation figure we should discuss is the 48-week end of study results from BEHOLD, phase 2 study of UBX1325 in patients with DME. It found that patients treated with UBX1325 had improvements in BCVA of 6.2 letters from baseline. So I wanted to ask you, what does that mean for DME patients?
Yeah, so look, I think anytime we talk about new mechanisms of action, I think it's exciting, right? Because I think we have all grown accustomed to the high bar that's been set by anti-VEGF. But, I think with the approval of faricimab, for example, we had our first new MOA or mechanism of action approved in our space since the original anti-VEGF. And so, UBX is a study being run by a company called Unity, and they're looking at targeting senescent cells, right? So what are they doing? They're trying to target these dead or decaying cells. I should say decaying cells. So let's take an endothelial kind of vessel, for example. The lining of that diabetic blood vessel is damaged, right? So especially in our DME patients. And what's happening in some of those vessels is that you've got endothelium that it's really just starting to go downhill. It's been diseased and it's not dead yet, but it's starting to die. Well, those cells don't work well. And as a result, you know, fluid extravasates from these vessels. You get leaky vessels, you get edema. And so what Unity is targeting is those cells. They're saying, look, our treatment is going to get rid of those cells and allow new healthy endothelium to grow in and line that blood vessel, which then kind of hits the reset button, theoretically hits the reset button on those vessels and almost kind of makes them shiny and new again, right? So, you know, that's a really different concept, right, than what we're doing right now with the anti-VEGFs. And so I think in theory, it makes a lot of sense. I'm really excited that this phase two study is showing pretty promising results, right? So we're seeing that after a year, these patients that got this study treatment are doing better than the patients that didn't receive it. And so that's the kind of difference we want to see. So, you know, how does this get rolled out in everyday use? If we can get to a phase three and see similar results and good results, you know, certainly it's something that could be an adjuvant to what we're using. You know, maybe we treat patients with anti-VEGF to stabilize them, and then we start throwing in this UBX drug in order to really kind of strengthen their overall anatomy, right? And in the long run, kind of turn back the clock on some of these diseased retinas, right? And so, you know, I think, look, it's exciting to see good phase two data. Obviously, we'll need to see good phase three data. But this is one that I'm kind of watching and closely following along with.
Sort of a thing that I would imagine, you know, goes across medicine. Like, everybody's going to be excited about a new drug class. So let me ask you sort of about your own excitement. At what point does it really get to where you start to feel like this agent is super promising and, you know, you think that it's going to go all the way? Is that something that's only in phase three or in a phase two study like this?
It's hard, right? Because, you know, for those of us that have been in phase twos where we've gotten really excited about them and then seen the phase three ultimately not get us to the end that we wanted, I have a kind of a tempered enthusiasm is what I would call it exactly. You know, so I would say, no, look, this is exciting. I mean, this is the fact that this type of a phase two study is reading out well and that it makes sense to me. Is what kind of all together those variables kind of generate the excitement for me. Do I think this could get all the way through? Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that could absolutely make its way through to us. And then, but look, it's still a while, right? Like, we still got to go through the phase three and we know those take time. I think that's part of the tempered enthusiasm that even though I think, look, this could make it all the way is a couple of years down the road still.
The next one, KSI-301, anti-VEGF antibody biopolymer conjugate for DME, first-time efficacy, durability, and safety results of the Gleam and Glimmer phase 3 studies. Now, as we both know, this did not meet the primary endpoint. So let me ask you if you want to run through that data a little bit.
Yeah, So let's talk about big picture. We just talked about, you know, our excitement with new molecules and new drugs that we're looking at in phase two, phase three studies. Why did I say my excitement was kind of tempered? It's because of studies like this, right? We saw KSI-301, we saw the phase 2B wet AMD program and what happened there, and we didn't get the readout that we wanted. And so I think when we looked at Gleam and Glimmer and our expectation for that, obviously the bar was kind of lowered a little bit because of what happened with their phase 2B. Different disease, wet AMD, and so maybe an irrational kind of this kind of fear that this wasn't going to work out. But look, at the end of the day, it really didn't. And I don't know if it was because of the drug necessarily. If you look at the data, I think what we saw in this data set was that the patients, and again, this was DME, so not wet AMD, but the patients that got the drug for DME, they actually did pretty well. Like, if you look at their matched phase at the very beginning of the study, these patients dried well, they did very well. you know, I think the issue here was really something nobody foresaw, which was a cataract issue, right? So what happened in this study was that a significant proportion of the study drug, the patients receiving study drug, got cataracts. And I think that impacted the end BCVA results, which ultimately was the primary endpoint for this study. And so when your vision suffers, you got, you know, even if it's a cataract, you know, and you're not kind of, you know, teasing that out, unfortunately, then you're not going to get the readout that you want. And unfortunately, again, I think there was signals that the drug was working. But at the end of the day, if your primary endpoint is vision and you didn't hit that mark, you didn't hit that mark. And so unfortunately, you know, what we saw on this one is, you know, the data was the data and they basically shut that program down, which is unfortunate because, you know, we've been hearing about it for years from Kodiak. We've been kind of, again, cautiously optimistic that this was going to be a great durable treatment for our patients, maybe getting patients out for every 4 month injections or every 6 month injections. But unfortunately, it didn't work out. And so, you know, this is why we do the studies. This is why we have the phases that we do. This is why we enroll so many patients in these trials. And at the end of the day, this one, again, didn't work out.
So let me ask you, just as a whole, you know, when there are studies like this that don't meet their endpoints, you know, is there anything to take away from it that's positive? You know, was there something maybe learned along the way? And I guess we could look at sort of trials in general. It doesn't necessarily have to be this one, but is there any sort of, you know, positive spin on this to put when there's, you know, data like this?
Yeah, I think the positive spin is that we're going to keep trying, right? I think we have things that are working. I think the problem is we've set the bar so high with our original kind of anti-VEGF that, you know, it's tough to beat those, right? It's tough to beat them. So I think the positive spin is we've got really good treatments that we're comparing against. I think the other thing about this one in particular with Glimmer and Gleam is that, you know, maybe we just got to tweak study design a little bit, right? And I think there's a lot of discussion on how study design potentially impacted their phase 2B study and eventually their phase 3 studies. And so, you know, learning from that, tinkering with that a little bit, you know, optimizing study design so that we don't have patients do poorly, you know, that might be something that we can gather from this as well and kind of, you know, use that moving forward for future study designs.
Obviously, these are only, I think we did 5 studies from ASRS. There's a ton of other, you know, crucial, important data that we missed. Is there anything in particular from the meeting or anything else going on in the field that you just want to hit on in an episode like this? You know, is there anything outside of ASRS that's really,
well,
you know?
Yeah, no, I think, look, it's interesting because it was, I think the last couple of ASRSs have really built on each other. You know, last year, we were really kind of gearing up for a potential GA drug, right? Like if you go back a year ago's ASRS, we didn't have any treatments for GA. And here we are today, you know, we have 2, right? And so, you know, those ASRS kind of, you know, prepped us for this point. Now what I'm seeing is we're kind of taking that information. We're starting to look at real-world data for these treatments. But there's a lot of real-world information that we've been talking about, whether it's the Truckee study looking at a faricimab or Vabysmo. We're going to probably start seeing a lot more real-world data on these GA drugs. You know, we learned a lot about port delivery system, for example, and we're seeing some updates on that. And so I don't think there's ever been a time, at least as a retina specialist, where so much is happening and not just so much. I mean, we've always had, you know, lots of clinical trials going on, but we're getting new treatments. In the last year, last 2 years, we've gotten like 4 new treatments. And if you look at Vabysmo, PDS, you know, the 2 GA treatments. So, biosimilars we didn't even mention, right? So we're getting all these new tools at a faster and faster rate. And I think this year's ASRS really kind of focused on that and then highlighted, look, what's in the pipeline. Look, in the next year or two, maybe couple years, we're talking about potentially gene therapies and rolling those out and longer acting, more durable agents like with TKIs, right? So we're on this, we are already kind of at this inflection point where we're seeing a lot more treatments kind of becoming available. So 2 things, we're going to get more treatments available in the next year or two, but we're also going to learn about real world, kind of what's happening in the real world with these treatments that we do now have in our toolbox, right? And that's part of it as well. So there's a lot to this ASRS, I think, that we're still digesting. I'm glad we took a minute to talk about it. I'm curious to see kind of what else people are excited about. I think, you know, upcoming meetings, including AAO and Retina Society, all these, I think there's going to be more and more data coming out, which is super exciting. Thank you for listening in to the New Insight podcast. We really appreciate your time. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.